Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome you to a special edition of Africa on the Move, a show that is dedicated to be the voice for the underserved communities, the oppressed communities, of those people whose history and contributions that have been left out in the so-called history books. And we want to be a voice where our word is heard, our contributions are recognized, and our actions must be known. That is, our positive actions. Today we will continue on a series that we've been doing on Africa Liberation Day 2014. This is the third part of the series of Africa Liberation Day 2014, Africans Must Unite, calling for African unity. And the best way to call for African unity is to talk to those who are out there organizing the community, who are trying to help bring about this community, I mean this unity among African people. Right now, we have two of our panelists, Brother Anthony Williams, who's an organizer for the All African Peoples Revolutionary Party, GC, and Brother Haki Kamafi Machoki. He's an organizer for the African Awareness Association. Brother Anthony, welcome to Africa on the Move.
Thanks, Brother Africa. Greatly appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
And Brother Haki, we welcome you also to Africa on the Move.
Thank you, Brother Africa.
Let's get started. Let's go straight to the source. We are commemorating basically 56 years of African Liberation Day. We're taking it from the inception of African Freedom Day, which took place April 15, 1958, which was the foundation in terms of the essence of African Liberation Day. We know on May 25, 1963, it was changed from African Freedom Day to African Liberation Day at the convening of the Organization of African Unity. Given that little brief history, Brother Anthony, as organizer for the All African People Revolutionary Party, give us your assessment and your historical understanding of the development of African Liberation Day as it relates to how GCs see this institution.
Okay. African Liberation Day has developed into an institution which is commemorated worldwide in Africa and outside of Africa. And historically, it has been celebrated in various sections of Africa, as well as the diaspora. And the purpose is to mark the achievements, the development of Pan-Africanism, which is the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. And we mark the forward progress of the African Revolution as well as other revolutionary movements going on throughout the world. And let's see, over the years, African Liberation Day has suffered numerous advances and setbacks paralleling the struggle to achieve Pan-Africanism, which has also suffered numerous achievements and setbacks as well over the years. However, there's always been a core of genuine, committed revolutionaries that have upheld, the true purpose of ALD and Pan-Africanism. And we view ourselves as the inheritors and continuators of that work that was sparked by Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, and Kwame Touré.
Okay. One of the things when we think about African Liberation Day, Brother Haki, we often talk about this issue of the land question. We talk about the land. In this case, the center point is Africa. Why is the question, the land question, is important when you're talking about trying to liberate African people here in the West and throughout the world?
Well, land is the basis of all freedom. Without the land, you can't just talk about liberation. So it's extremely important To give you an example, if you look at the situation currently in South Africa in terms of where you get 70% of the population currently on the most uninhabitable, the most arid land, the political power to a large extent is marginalized simply because they don't have access to the land in terms of growing food for various other kind of uses in terms of factories and so forth and so on. So land is extremely, extremely important. And now if you look at a situation where you have in Zimbabwe in terms of, you know, Robert Mugabe's desire in terms of controlling the land, one of the things we were very clear on that the British government was extremely in opposition along with the American government in terms of allowing you know, the indigenous people, the African people, to reclaim the land because they understand that with the land comes the power. And so they've been fighting Mugabe for a long, long time to make sure that doesn't come to fruition. So the land is, in fact, very, very important. So we're going to talk about, a united Africa and the science of socialism. Then the question in terms of land has to figure prominently in terms of that discussion.
Okay, and Brother Anthony, also another component of African Liberation Day, when we talk about African Liberation Day, we talk about this concept called the identity question. How does the identity question play into the equation of trying to unify our people to fight for, organize around the liberation of Africa and African people worldwide? Talk about this importance, the importance of this identity question. And how do you convince the African in the West?
Go ahead, sorry.
No, you could go ahead. I was just going to say a lot of time, I was just in a recent discussion with some young folks, and they were telling me, brother, I hear what you're saying, but I was born here. This is where we live. This is what I'm going to do. How do you convince our people to educate them on the points of the identity question? How you want to make them
A lot of our people, particularly in the diaspora and on the continent as well to a certain extent, have an incomplete view of our history. Where you're physically born is not the sole determining factor of your identity. And this issue of identity is tied in very closely with the land question also. That Brother Haki had dealt with earlier. As was pointed out by a fellow comrade, landlessness is a common problem faced by Africans on the continent and in the diaspora. The Africans in the diaspora were taken from our land, Africa, and the Africans at home had their land stolen from them. So landlessness is a common, it's a common problem. Our problem in terms of us seeing that is because, our history is presented from the advent of colonialism or chattel slavery, depending upon what part of the world you're in. And very little information, little discussion takes place about our history prior to the foreign invasions, and I think that's why there's so much confusion regarding our identity, and too often because we do not have a proper view of our history, we're allowing our enemies to define us instead of us defining ourselves. But that's difficult, because We don't have an adequate view of our history.
Okay, so when we talk about African Liberation Day, when we talk about the identity question, we also have to talk about this whole question of revolution versus reform. Brother Haki, when we talk about revolution versus reform, it's clear when we look at the problems and conditions of our people, reform is not the solution. It must be come to a process of a revolutionary process. We must struggle for revolution, seeking a change. Why is it important to educate our people on the necessity for an African revolution versus to continue to go on these reforms that we see on a daily basis that don't solve our people's problems?
Yeah, well, simply stated, reforms doesn't get to the meat of the matter. I mean, the problems that are confronting our people takes, you know, concrete solutions. Forum tend to be superficial in terms of, you know, is resolution in terms of problems that our people face. So, if, for instance, in America, you got a situation where you got Barack Obama as President of the United States. You know, he would talk about something like the minimum wage, but he talks about minimum wage as relates only to the federal employees. Now, the irony is that when you talk about minimum wage as it applies to federal employees, $10 and 10 cents an hour is not even relevant to federal employees, because most federal employees make more than $10 and 10 cents already anyway. So that kind of reform, that the illusion that, in fact, that you're addressing, you know, some deep-seated problems, it's just that it's an illusion. And so people also get bogged down in the illusion as opposed to what pragmatically, I mean, you know, concretely what has to happen in terms of redressing the problem that you're confronted with. So revolution, we talk about revolution, we're talking about a total transformation of society in which, you know, the social, economic, political systems are under the power and control of the African masses of people. To truly be in a position to dictate in terms of what is in the best interest of Africa in terms of moving forward. Now, having said that, we have to also understand that clearly there are those neocolonial elements in Africa, you know, who work for the West, the best interest of the West, who are not interested in, you know, a liberated and free and autonomous Africa. And so, therefore, we should understand that. So one of the things we don't want to do when we talk about revolution in terms of Africa, what we don't want to do is promote irrational leadership which is corrupt, greedy, you know, who are manipulated by the West to carry out their will to the detriment of the African people. So we have to be very, very clear that the kind of leadership that we want, the kind of leadership that represents African people, has to be bona fide leadership who has the best interests and aspirations of its people at heart, and to begin to create a political, economic, social system that reflect that seriousness in terms of, you know, changing that paradigm as it relates to Africa. So reform is something that is surreptitious. Revolution is something real, something tangible. So the struggle is for something tangible, something real.
And Brother Anthony, being in the Revolutionary Party, how would you like to add to this discussion of reform versus revolution?
Yes. Reform is a form of preservation of capitalism. And what it does is kind of like a Band-Aid, you know, that doesn't adequately address a very serious wound that our people are suffering from, mainly because it tends to preserve the present system while removing certain irritants. For example, capitalism is a form of slavery. You know, the principles that underlie capitalism and slavery are the same. Reform, as is a change in the method in which those principles are carried out. Revolution is a change in the social order into its opposite. Revolution seeks socialism, in which is an economic system in which all own and all eat, whereas capitalism is a system in which a few control and a few eat while the masses of the people starve. And that must be hammered home to our people. And for the most part, the reason why our struggle with the neocolonialist intelligentsia is so key is because they're blocking the people's access to that knowledge that they need to make a more informed decision. And they tend to blur things in the surface of capitalism.
Okay, we like to let
let me weigh in on that. When Brother Anthony talks about the capitalism is sort of slavery, there's no question about it. Capitalism is the epitome of slavery, and we really have to understand that. In the context of capitalist society, we understand that when we talk about the value of money, we have to understand that the value of money is not something in terms of social good, even though historically when we look at the role of money, that historically it's been viewed as a social good. And so even if you look at the most ancient societies on the planet, Egypt, Somalia, Sudan, you know, China, and so forth and so on, when you look at terms of the evolution of money, it's always been a social vehicle, a vehicle in which you simply use as a means of credit, a means of, you know, exchanging goods in a way that would suggest that credit is involved. And so it's a way of making sure people get what they need in terms of using some something, whether it be coins, shells, sticks, or whatever it may be. Now, that reality changed in the continent in the 13th century in terms of Western Europe, in which money no longer was perceived as a social good, that money was perceived as a commodity. And it's because of the perceived as a commodity that we have to understand that it has, for those who have access to it, is very personal. They don't want to share it. They want to keep it. And so the struggle for them is to find out ways to keep it. And so when we talk about the context of global society, global economics, then we're very, very clear in terms of, when we look right now in the terms of the disparity between the 1% and everybody else, and we look at the distance in terms of between those who have and those who don't have, then it's clearly that disparity is growing leaps and bounds. And the question is, why is that disparity growing leaps and bounds? Now, when you think about it, now, if in the context of the capitalist system, that if you don't have money flowing through the system, then that's no possible way for that economy to expand. But what happened is that currently what's happening under global capitalism is that the money is going to the top, so there's no money actually going into the system for expansion to take place in the first place. The reason being is because of those who have money, it's a commodity, it's power. So for them, it's not about sharing. It's about denying people, you know, access to that commodity. And so therefore, in the minds of those ruling class, those people who run the society, you are slaves. Because if you can't concretely contribute economically to the viability of the economic order, then as far as they're concerned, you're slaves. Your existence on this planet is esoteric, is irrelevant, and for them the question becomes, what do we do with those excess surplus baggage that we need to get rid of? And so we had to understand clearly in terms of capitalism, for those people who got the job thinking that they're living large, you know, relative, let's say, brothers and sisters in Africa or the Caribbean or Central South America. The reality is that even if you think that you're living large, the reality is you're not living large. You know, so the implication being that we have to understand that our worth as human beings, as far as capitalist mindset is concerned, only value exists to the extent that you actually have money or wealth. And this is the paradox that we're confronted with as we found out struggle, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to arrive at a more just, more harmonious, you know, society. Socialism is the way to go in terms of changing that paradox, in terms of, you know, once again, making people human beings where money serves the needs of human beings, not the interests of power or not the interests of capital per se. So this is a struggle that we're confronted with as people. So this is the thing that we have to be very, very concerned about, in particular Africa.
Okay. Since you raised it in the context of Haki, I'm going to ask Brother Anthony to talk a little bit about this S word, where they have everybody scared to say. And it's ironic in terms of the contradiction. They will holler about their capitalists, and that's a concept that's oppressing them, while at the same time they're scared to say the S word. Anthony, can you talk to our people, what is the value of transforming our society into the S word that we call socialism? How would that look? What would it do? How would it distinguish itself in terms of changing the lives of the folks? Give me your take on that, Anthony.
Certainly. Well, under socialism, the priority is that it becomes human beings as a whole, the collectivity of people. And with the wealth, it would become a tool to serve the interests and development of the masses of the people, so that things that are really human rights become accessible to everybody, such as health care, education, employment, retirement, a pension, you know, to survive when you're no longer able to work. And also a mechanism for caring for those people who are no longer able to contribute productively to society, but are not cast aside as they are into capitalism. And the clearest way to show that is to look an example of a society that's trying to build socialism, such as Cuba. And that's why, Cuba's example becomes so important, and why the U.S. has worked so hard for 55 years to try to overturn the Cuban Revolution. Because Cuba is not by any means a military threat to the U.S. interests, but it is an ideological threat. Lee?
Hello?
Brother Africa? Okay. Yeah, I thought we may have lost you. Okay, no problem. In terms of this question of socialism, Brother Hackey, we also realize that, a lot of time one of the things they do in terms of to create confusion among the people, they use important concepts and terms in a way where it is dialectically the opposite of what they mean. For example, they are using the concept of socialism and associating it with Barack Obama administration, Barack Obama. How do you view this issue of socialism as being labeled on Barack Obama?
Well, first of all, there's nothing socialist about Barack Obama. That's the first thing. But when the right wing uses socialism, it's simply as a ploy to deceive people, to make people think it's somehow it's something bad. In other words, if any policy doesn't represent the interests of the ruling class, then it's socialism. It doesn't have any concrete meaning. It doesn't have any coherent meaning, any tangent meaning in terms of, when they use that word socialism. It's just a ploy to decide to deceive people. But when we talk about socialism in the context of America, let's talk about what socialism really is. If you think back to 2008, in terms of the whole subprime debacle, in terms of, one of the things that when Barack Obama spent that $1.7 trillion, in terms of putting money into the corporations, putting money in, to the financial institutions, the banks and so forth. The thing is that you understand that money comes from somewhere. That money collectively belongs to the people of the United States. But what they did was they took the money in the United States and they transferred it to the very, very wealthy. So in other words, it was centrally planned by individuals who decided that we're going to build these finance institutions. So they took our money to do it. That's socialism. Of course, they're not going to call it socialism. That's what it is. So when you use the people's money in terms of empowering another aspect of society, then it's socialism. Of course, they're not going to call it socialism because they want you to think socialism is a bad thing. Also, when I talked earlier about the disparity between those who have and those who don't have, now when we talk about the function, of inflation, we talk about interest rates, or we talk about exchange rates, all this stuff is ways in which, when you study, it's ways in which they transfer money from the poor people to the very wealthy people. So it's all socialism. See, the ruling class don't have a problem with socialism as long as they benefit from socialism. They have a problem with socialism when you talk about applying the people's money for the people's need. That's when it becomes problematic. So don't be deceived in terms of socialism. It's not a bad thing. And in fact, if you look at China, and China's economy is centrally controlled, one of the reasons why China is doing so well is because the economy is centrally controlled and they can allocate the resources according to the needs of the nation. America doesn't like that because China, in fact, is in another 3 to 4 years, in fact, is going to be the number one economic power in the world. And they don't call China socialist. They call everything under the sun, but they won't call it socialist. Even though China is not totally socialist, at least it has incorporated some socialist principles. Now, when we look at Cuba is a good example in terms of creating a socialist order. And when you look at it in terms of the health, the education, and you look at the standards as it relates to the Cuban people, it's off the charts. The Cuban people are extremely intelligent, extremely healthy. And one would wonder how the hell in such a small, poor nation they can do all that for their people, but you got one of the wealthiest country in the world where the people are not educated, the people are not healthy. So how do you explain that irony? Now, another thing is that when you talk about socialism in terms of the positive attributes of socialism, consistently, when you talk about socialism on a world scale, the ten most prosperous, the ten most vibrant economies are socialist economies, and they're Scandinavian nations, and they're all socialists, and they're unapologetically socialist. Now, when you look at those nations in terms of health, in terms of education, shelter, clothing, food, blah, 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 I mean, this whole socioeconomic spectrum, those people consistently rank at the top year after year after year after year, and that's the reason why. It's because of the kind of system that they live under. When you contrast that to the American term, the kind of system that we live under, the total is a different ballgame. We don't have access to housing. We don't have health care. We don't have access to health care. We don't have access to good food. I mean, matter of fact, the kind of food that we're privy to by and large in these cities are subpar. I mean, subpar in terms of its quality. So, you know, so clearly, you know, socialism is much more preferable. Now, one last thing. If you contrast Canada with America, I mean 500 miles to the north from Virginia, if you contrast them, I mean there's a night and day difference in terms of the two. Canada is socialist. One of the things I talked to one of the high ranking members of Canada government some years back, and he was explaining that that Canada would never accept the kind of disparity between the have and the have-nots in Canada, simply because it's not workable, because it's not sustainable. They prefer not to have a society in which you have to watch your back when you walk the street at nighttime. They prefer not to have kids go to school who are hungry, whose bellies are growling, who can't learn because they're hungry. They prefer not to have people live on the streets, you know, like, for instance, in New York, where you people in the subway who are on a platform laying there, you know, homeless, you know, I mean, serious distress. I mean, all kind of diseases and everything. And people just literally just step right over top of them and pretend like they're not even there. Only capitalism can produce that kind of mindset in a human being, that you become so callous and so cold that you can literally step over another human being, you know, who's in distress and not give a second another thought about it. This is the kind of society that America produces. This is what capitalism produces. Nobody wants that. Now it's time for a new paradigm in which, you know, that we elevate the value of human beings. And the only way you can elevate the demands of human beings is to create a social order which is consistent with elevating the needs and aspirations of human beings. That's why socialism is so important, you know, to the world and to Africa.
Okay, we'd like to let our listening audience know that you're listening to Africa on the Move as your host, Brother Africa. We are talking about and celebrating, going to be commemorating Africa Liberation Day 2014. That's coming up March the 17th. Brother Anthony, I know that this African Liberation Day that's coming up March the 17th in Washington, D.C. has been organized by your organization, All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Can you talk about this year's theme and why y'all chose this year's theme? And we also would like to let our audience know in a few minutes, if you have a comment or a question, make sure you punch number one, so we can recognize your number and we'll call out your last four numbers. So if you want to be heard and share this conversation, which we invite you, we're really going to be talking about African Liberation Day and African unity. Africans must unite for this particular program. Make sure you punch number one, and we will call out the last four numbers. So right now, Brother Anthony, you can make give our people some understanding of what is the theme this year, why you chose the theme. And then I see on the board now we have one of our youth, Brother Jabari. We'll be coming to him next. But go ahead, Brother Anthony.
Certainly. Our theme this year is Smash the Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. And the reason why we chose this theme is because neocolonialism is the primary a way in which imperialism is manifesting itself in Africa and around the world today through a system of indirect control. And neocolonialism is a system in which capitalism co-opts a certain sector of the people to serve the interests of capitalism to the detriment of the people from which they come from. To give an example of that is a lot of the African petty bourgeoisie. They are that's where the neocolonialist intelligentsia comes from. They have the aspirations to become the bourgeoisie. They're not interested in genuine revolutionary change, which is what the majority of the people in the world really want. But their role of this intelligentsia is to sow confusion among our people as regards to our history, religion, etc. And they are represented in all sectors of African society, whether you're talking about entertainment, education, sports, media, etc. And their role is to serve the interests of the capitalist class against the interests of the people. And they're the major reason why there's so much confusion as to our identity, as to our understanding of socialism in our community today.
Okay, we have.
And so that's how it shows this thing.
Okay, we'll come back to that because I think that's a very interesting thing, and it's trying to give our people some clarity in terms of how to identify the enemy. And we're going to talk about this question, how to identify the enemy. But right now we have our brother Jabari, who's one of our youth leaders. We'd like to welcome to Africa on the Move, ask Brother Jabari. Why do you think it's important for us to support the institution of African Liberation Day, Brother Jabari, from your perspective as a youth today? Why is it important to support African Liberation Day as an institution and connect ourselves with Mother Africa?
Well, given my age, it holds a special importance because a person not so much younger than myself now by the name of Stokely Carmichael was a student leader and one right-hand man of Dr. Martin Luther King, and he was very active in the pushing for liberation in terms of civil rights in America, as well as very active in communicating with those abroad because he later took on the name Kwame Ture, and that was our tribute to Sekou Ture and Kwame Nkrumah. And just I can just remember, I recently went to Howard University where Kwame was an alumni, and the speaker was careful to note that because of Kwame, everybody knows about the chapel because he had such a worldwide influence. And the example he set for us is because as a young person, he saw that the way things are aren't the way things should be, and there has to be a way that we can uplift the fact that black people have pride, black people have dignity, black people have self-worth, and we need to get away from this mind state that we have to embrace Eurocentrism, and that's the way we're supposed to conduct ourselves.
Okay, excellent, excellent. We also have another panelist today who has just joined us, Brother Skip Bailey. Brother Skip, how are you today?
Good evening, brothers. How you been?
Good. We've been struggling, brothers. You know, where there's struggle, there's progress, and that's what we're going to try to do tonight. Brother Skip, we've been talking about really the whole essence of what makes up African Liberation Day as an institution, and we're going to be going more into really looking at this whole issue of how do we bring about African unity and what are some of the contradictions and how we move forward. But in the process, when we're talking about African Liberation Day, we know it's a part of the world social revolution. And earlier, some of the panelists talked about the influence or looking at the alternative that oppressed people have as relates to socialism. And I know you have had a chance to visit Africa and spend a lot of time in Cuba. And Cuba is the leading country right now in terms of the practical and theoretical aspect of socialism. Well, you talk to the people from your experience.
I think, my brother, let me say two things. I think this is probably the most critical time in the period of the history of mankind for people of African descent. When you look at South Africa, when you look at the great betrayal that has taken place with the liberation movements, they were given their credibility. The ANC was given its credibility through its relationship with the African Liberation Movement. What brought the ANC to the forefront of that broad national struggle was right here in Washington, D.C., Stokely Carmichael, all the brothers that were committed for a structural change in Southern Africa. So I'm afraid, brother, the African National Congress, Ramaphosa, and Becky, the new president, I'm not going to call his name, has betrayed the whole concept of African liberation to the point that the economic situation in Southern Africa, Angola and Southern Africa, is worse than it was under apartheid. And I think what we critically have to talk about is the betrayal of so many African so-called liberation leaders to the masses of Southern African people. I just would like to say that and get some feedback from your listening audience about that, particularly South Africa and the killing of 79 miners. No lights, no heat. Ramaphosa, remember Ramaphosa and then Becky were here at Howard University. Made the links with Stokely, made the links with the boy out of Milwaukee, made the links with all of the frontline African liberation organizers in 1973, 74, 75, 76. We put them on the map. And Becky really turned his head against the people.
Well, let's do that. Let's just put that fundamental question out to our panelists and to our audience. To our audience, we will open up our phone line now. Feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841. And when you call in, make sure you hit 1 if you want to be heard. So the question is, we're really talking about African leadership today. Where is the African leadership today, and what is the present reality and crisis in Africa, if some people want to call it a crisis? So, Brother Hackney, you just came back from Southern Africa. Skip just made an assessment of, particularly in the southern part of Africa, that the leadership has betrayed the cause of the people. How do you assess that position on that comment? Where are you on that?
No, the brother's absolutely correct. I mean, the situation currently in South Africa is horrendous. I mean, no question about that. Nothing has changed. Nothing at all has changed. I mean, you got a few corrupt Africans in positions of leadership who could care less about the aspirations and needs of their people. Don't even talk about it. Zuma is this guy is not particularly bright. I mean, but this is how corrupt he is. When I was there, he was talking about they were trying to pass a law in which they want everything more transparent. Zuma position was, no, we can't have transparency in Africa because it doesn't work in Africa in the African context. I mean, that's what he said. I mean, this is how absurd it is, but that's what he said. He's got his big house and he's spending millions of dollars on his house, personal funds he's taking from ANC, and he's using it to embellish his home. So this guy is a quintessential hack or quintessential crook or whatever you want to call him. But in terms of concrete, in terms of the conditions that the people face, I mean, it's pretty bad. I mean, the homelessness and the Bantustans are not decreasing. They're actually increasing. And it's a very, very dangerous place in terms of, in an attempt to access electricity, people having wires from one shack. They're not even shacks. They're worse than shacks. I don't even know how you define them in terms of housing, but it's like a corrugated steel. And it's, so it, what happens is that they have wires running from one dwelling to the next. And so they're very dangerous. So the situation where people are getting fried by electricity and fires is pretty common in South Africa. In terms of access to clean water, it's unbelievable. They won't even put wells. They won't even drill more wells in the Bantustans in the slums for the people. They just won't do it. And the sewage, and in terms of the sewage that run, I went to a couple of townships. I stayed in one. I stayed in Guguletu, and it was horrible in terms of just 50 yards away the sewage that ran, and the kids go in there and they would play around that stuff, and it was just horrible. I mean, the level of poverty was such that in terms of getting by, the way people get by is basically a homemade beer. I forgot what they call it, but it's a homemade beer. And it's sort of filling, but that gets them by because there's no food. I mean, there's no food. They have a little cost, which the people can't afford to patronize because they have no money. To the extent that people have access to a meal, they have family members who might have a job who can bang a little something from the workplace and share with the people there. So you got a situation with these shacks where you have to have 3-4 families in one little shack. So it's pretty horrendous. It's pretty bad. And there is no concern being expressed by the ANC, and in particular Zuma, who's in position of leadership there. I talked to some political prisoners there about the situation in terms of the land question. And a few of the brothers were talking about, well, we're ready to go back to the bush, you know what I mean? Because this is simply, you know, this is simply unacceptable. And I talked to him about why didn't they deal with the land question? He said, well, brother, he said, listen, we weren't allowed to even bring up the land question during negotiations. That part of the conditions that to release Mandela said that the land question could not be discussed. You couldn't even bring it up. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah. He said, what about today? He said, even today, we can't discuss the land question because the possibility that if we do that, then it's always a possibility that you'll be back in prison. He said, but at this point, you know, a lot of us are ready to go back to prison because this is just unacceptable. So the situation is very, very grim. It's still a situation when you go to Cape Town, it looks like Europe. The white folks are living well up on the hill, and then you go further west in Cape Town where you grab some Africans, and it's slummy. It's horrible. So it's not ideal. And clearly ANC has betrayed the aspirations of the masses of people in South Africa. But the resentment and the anger is growing. So I talked to a lot of brothers and sisters in Guguletu, you know, about in terms of their feelings in terms of what's going on. And a lot of them are very, very angry. So the anger is growing. And so they realize, there's awareness that they've been betrayed. And PAC is gaining momentum in South Africa. So we'll see what happens in the future.
Brother Anthony, what is the party position? I mean, it seems like what we are talking about ties very closely to y'all this year theme as it relates to neocolonialism and ties this year to the true face of the counter-revolution. But in terms of doing an assessment on Africa and its leadership, and the sole question of neocolonialism, where did your party come in at? What is our position on it?
In order for a political party to be truly revolutionary, it has to be guided by a revolutionary ideology. The level of corruption that we're seeing from some of these liberation organizations that we thought were about, you know, freedom of the people is a reflection of the fact that in a lot of cases their organizers were not guided by genuinely revolutionary ideology. And Nkrumah pointed out during the time he was prime minister of Ghana and tried to build socialism in Ghana, that you have to have socialists to build socialism. So I think the way to counter your neocolonialist intelligentsia is to develop a revolutionary intelligentsia. But you can only do that if your political party is guided by a revolutionary ideology. And for Africa, that correct ideology is Nkrumahism, Thuraism. And it's called such because it's based upon the work, practices, writings, and struggles of Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré. And Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, and Kwame Touré were the foremost exponents of that ideology. So a lot of the problems that Africa's faced with its leadership is because those parties that led them to nominal independence were in a lot of cases not guided by a genuinely revolutionary ideology. And so therefore, the enemy's ideas crept in a lot of these organizations.
Brother Zimbabwe, would you like to make us a response to this question?
Well, I would like to say in response, I feel like Brother IP and Brother Anthony did a very astute job of analyzing the current political climate. And I will also add to the fact that to ensure that... Am I good to continue?
Yes,
Yeah, go ahead, finish your point.
Hello?
I don't know what number it is.
Yes, go ahead, finish your point.
Yeah, hey, Am I okay?
Yes, you're okay. Go ahead.
Okay. As I was saying, in regards to the state of affairs as is with African leadership, it's very interesting that you notice that there's an increase in number of military units that have arrived, especially when you look at AFRICOM as well as smaller units that support AFRICOM. And you notice that anybody that has a hint, anybody that suggests just a hint of going against neo-colonial presence, those countries may be a subject to being invaded or having sanctions put up against them, and also have military strategically placed to be looking right there in a neighboring country to prevent them from having any kind of forward progress. And they're doing that to disillusion, to prevent hope from being stymied, and to prevent the people from truly understanding the dire straits that they find themselves in.
Okay, you know, I was going to think we was going down the road along with the issue that Skip has raised is directly tied to this issue of this question of development. You know, there's a question of why Africa is undeveloped, and put the word development in quotation mark in terms of how we define it. When we talk about undevelopment, I'm talking about in terms of why Africa has not been able to fully reach its human and material capacity. And it has, because when we look at what's going on today, there's a historical history that led up today. So to Brother Haki, give me your analysis on the lack of so-called African development. If they are developed, who are the forces that played a role into it, and who do we really hold us responsible?
Well, Africa's development is the result of Western strategies in terms of making damn sure Africa doesn't develop. The Western interest in Africa is purely relates to resources. And so therefore, historically as well as currently, the situation has always been how can we best extract resources from Africa? How can we manipulate the leadership in Africa to get what we need? Sadly, and when we talk about neocolonialism, we talk about the role the corrupt leadership in Africa play in terms of the underdevelopment of the country. It's a sad commentary, but nonetheless, it's very, very true. In fact, you know, they've been very, very instrumental, very, very successful in terms of, you know, co-opting and corrupting African leadership in terms of large sums of money. Now, typically, when there's Western investments in Africa, normally the investments are, they come with a string. Normally, Western nations will tell them how the money can be spent. Now, one of the things that has been happening is that these clever leaders in these African states have managed to take those resources and divert them to their funds. Now, of course, the West knows precisely what they're doing. So what it is a very slick quid pro quo. We're going to give you this money under the guise that you're going to build roads, but in reality, we know you're going to use it and put it in your bank account. Wink, wink. And so therefore, it's all good. So therefore, it's all geared toward making sure Africa remains undeveloped. And also, this question in terms of, you know, global treaties, you know, treaties that exist globally. One of the things is that when you have these Western governments set up in Africa in terms of dictating the terms, you know, in terms of the economic terms, you know, in terms of how things actually exist in Africa, one of the things is that you have a very difficult time in terms of actually trying to use the resources in the most efficient manner, because the Western nations are not concerned about efficiency. What Western nations are concerned about is the maximization of those resources, in turn maximizing the amount of money they can get for Africa's resources. So that is their focus. And so Africa, unfortunately, are privy to have been involved in a lot of these nefarious kinds of policies that are not good for Africa. I think too that one of the things is that and the point evades me, but I was thinking that you got a situation on a continent where you got people actually walking around. I mean, very, very educated people walking around with nothing to do. And the question in terms of just what, how do you maximize these people's potential has never been a question in Africa. So to the extent that greed and avarice exist in Africa, it's destroying Africa. It's really destroying Africa. And Western nations are well aware of this, and this is the reason why, one of the reasons why they have the military in Africa. They got 52 states. Africa has 54 states. Out of 54, they got 52 countries which are occupied by the Western military. And so, therefore, the notion is that if robbery doesn't work, then we're always going to resort to force. And also they're there to identify exactly who's who in terms of who's progressive, who's revolutionary, as potential target. So Africa is underdeveloped simply because there's been a long history, more current history in terms of making damn sure it doesn't prosper. Recently, I'll say this and I'll conclude. Recently, a lot of West African nations have been forced to give up resources to the French government to the tune of $3 billion a year. $3 billion a year. This is extremely unfortunate. I mean, these economies are struggling, but they got to give the French $3 billion a year under the guise that the African nations have to repay the French for the infrastructure that it actually placed in Africa during the time of colonization. So it's sort of absurd, but that's precisely what's happening. And so the struggle for Africa is a difficult one. So we need Africans throughout the diaspora to understand what the issues are, and we have to bring clarity in terms of exactly why Africa is underdeveloped and what we have to do in terms of changing that paradigm.
And Avery, what is your take on this question of Africa, so-called underdevelopment, and what are some of the obstacles and who are some of the forces that played a major role towards them not being able to reach their potential up to this point and capabilities?
Okay. I want to follow up on what Brother Haki had pointed out, and that the points he raised about some of Africa's problems in terms of development speak to the need for our unity. As long as Africa remains divided into small micro states, about 50, I think Haki had mentioned 54, something like that, then they're not politically, economically, or militarily viable for the most part, and they're subject by manipulation by these powerful imperialist forces. A united Africa would be able to withstand that kind of pressure and would be able to assist on a fair price for its resources. And I think that's a material example of why African unity is important. And also, I would add that that one of the things that has been done is that during colonialism, the imperialists controlled the educational system of our people for the most part. And so colonialism asserted its influence over our youth during the time of colonialism and inculcated a lot of the intelligentsia with bourgeois ideology. And that is the root of the corrupt leadership that exists not only on the African continent, but in the diaspora as well. I mean, the situation you described taking place in Southern Africa is not too terribly different from what the masses of Africans face in the diaspora, particularly in the capitalist countries such as Britain, U.S., France, etc. So I think the key is unification. But but there are various forces that are working night and day against that, and again, to keep us divided so that we can't see, that we have a common problem, and therefore we have to work together toward to find a common solution for it.
Keep along the theme, Brother Anthony, and I'll come back to Brother Haki and Jabari. It seems to be one of the problems that Africa has faced and is facing is this micronationalism. That is to say, how can one give up the interests of the small microstate for the interests of the state of the whole development of the continent as one unified force? How do you speak to this question of the problem of micronationalism? How do you overcome that, Anthony? What is your policy solution to that? What are some things we need to look at to not only resolve that in the context of Africa, but even outside of Africa? How do we take these Africans who were born in America, or you're born in Haiti, who were born in Brazil, and make them realize that their commitment should be geared towards Africa primary, but we understand where we are, we see how to struggle. Because as long as we see ourselves as different entities, how can we function as one unit? How do you deal with that dilemma, that obstacle?
I think political education of our people becomes critical. This is another area where we have to be educated about our commonalities. And also we have to, you know, smash the stereotypes that we're fed about each other. And we fed a lot of that. And also, a lot of countries have a certain, especially the capitalist countries, have a very chauvinistic attitude. They think their system is the best in the world. And the thing about it, though, it permeates the diaspora. I mean, people who grew up in the U.S. are taught that somehow they're superior to everybody else, vice versa in France, this adds to that problem in terms of us coming together. And also, again, not adequately understanding our history in its proper context, and that we have similar roots, and that your identity is not determined by where the slave ship happened to leave our ancestors. And I did want to point out that neocolonialism, even though it is devastating Africa, was actually developed outside of Africa. It was actually developed in the Western Hemisphere. One of the first victims of it was Haiti. Hakia pointed out earlier that some of the countries in West Africa are forced to pay France reparations. France and the U.S. forced Haiti to pay reparations to France for the infrastructural damage, the loss of property by the French plantation owners in Haiti. So there's a history of this taking place, and we have to understand it and we have to counter it. But again, it takes an understanding of what our collective struggle has been, and we have to intensify the political education of our people, and that's why our party puts such an emphasis on cadre development.
Tell our brother Jabari, what is your take on Jabari? How do you see what would it take to have Africans in different places give up their micro-nationalism for the interests of the whole development of the continent of Africa?
Well, I think that would, and as the brother said earlier, that would be a reshifting of the paradigm and getting away from, the chains of neocolonialism that have held us down for so long, because, we've gotten to the point now, in regards to American political climate, we're so confused about our black identity that there's open racism right in front of our faces, and now once we bad not to speak out against it, but we just take it as is. I mean, you have people who are not of black skin using the N-word with E-R on the end as if, it's a joke, and we go along with it laughing as if there's something funny. So we've just been so disconnected by what it means to be black and what it means to be proud to be black that we just accept the okey-doke over and over again, because that's what being put in front of us. Because you notice in the media, they don't put us oftentimes in thinking positions or positions where
were able to articulate a point of view, you know, with some sort of buffoonery, some sort of stereotype. And people mass marketing, they do the same show over and over again, yet nobody takes a chance to even question what's really going on.
Okay, let's transition a little bit. We're talking about celebrating African Liberation Day 2014, and we start out talking about the different aspects and features and components of what make up the institution of African Liberation Day. Now, given the fact that we have stated those 2 points, let's talk a little bit about it more concretely and try to make a connection on why this institution is important as it relates to our people's ongoing progress and the future. Let's talk a little bit about this recent incident that took place in Nigeria. They call it the Boko Haram, about these students, young ladies, young girls in school, and some kind of way they just disappeared. They got hijacked. Now, what were the conditions that would allow something like this to happen? And the government seemed to have no response, no idea on what took place on their large sums of young youth disappeared. That remind me a lot of what did you tell me about so-called enslavery days. That's how a lot of our people disappear among themselves and no one seemed to know about it. Brother Haki, what is your analysis of how could this even happen and we have such a lack of response as of today in terms of what is going on?
Well, you know, that whole Boko Haram incident, you know, for me it's problematic because, you know, nothing that Boko, allegedly the group called Boko Haram, if they, in fact it's a group, nothing that they do makes any theoretical sense. It doesn't make any strategic sense. It doesn't make any tactical sense. So I'm not impressed to even believe that, in fact, that these people are a legitimate expression in terms of revolution, you know, on the continent of Africa. You know, one of the things is that when you sit there and you kill innocent people, you know, farmers, or you kidnap little girls, what do you hope to achieve by initiating such a tactic? What are the potential benefits? There are none. There's only downsides. So it doesn't make any sense to me. One thing that we do know that Boko Haram was financed by the CIA. I go a step further. I would speculate that perhaps Boko Haram is in fact people who work for the CIA in terms of working really, really go really what they're really after is to destabilize Nigeria. Why destabilize Nigeria? Well, Nigeria is the wealthiest country in Africa. Nigeria has a lot of scientists, a lot of engineers, you know, a lot of educated people. So therefore, if it constitutes, as far as the West is concerned, it undermines Western interests. So to destabilize Nigeria is something that they would need. And I could see that by financing or formulating this whole notion of some Boko Haram, that distract Africa leadership away from what it should be doing in terms of the empowerment of its people, and consequently, you know, the empowerment of the whole continent in terms of economic terms. So I think the goal is to destabilize Nigeria. I really do. Now, the reason what makes me really suspicious is that when you look at the U.S. conduct in terms of allegedly wanting to help, well, they decide they're going to send 10 soldiers over to Nigeria. Now, you say you want to help, but you send 10 soldiers to Nigeria? That, to me, makes no sense at all unless you want the so-called Boko Haram to succeed in terms of, you know, its strategy. Now, one of the things is that, you know, like you said, Brother Africa, I don't understand how it is that you could kidnap close to 287 people, girls, and you just vanish like a fart in the wind. I don't understand that. None of that makes any sense to me. Nobody seems to know anything. That's an awful lot of people, particularly young females, to carry around, and nobody knows nothing. Good luck, Jonathan, the president of Nigeria, he doesn't seem to be too concerned in terms of what's going on as related to Boko Haram. So none of this makes any sense to me at all. Has Jonathan been paid off by the CIA? Man, who knows? Who knows? Stranger things have happened in Africa. But none of it makes any sense to me at all in terms of this Boko Haram. So, you know, I'm hard pressed to even understand exactly what's going on.
Anthony, what's your take on it?
Okay. Well, let's see. I want to pick up on an observation that Brother Hakeem made, that Boko Haram was created by the CIA. And one of the tactics of, CIA and other intelligence forces is to create front organizations to sow confusion or disunity in a certain geographical area. Now, Nigeria, as has been pointed out, it's the wealthiest state in West Africa, and one of the largest in terms of population. And one of the things that the U.S. is concerned about, U.S. government is concerned about Nigeria's influence in West Africa. So they're trying to undermine that by creating this destabilization situation. And this is compounded by the fact that Nigeria's unity has historically always been very fragile, throughout its history. So I think it's a combination of divide and conquer, and in the case they're doing it through, Africans, people that look like us, but don't really represent our interests, and that's where the smokescreen comes in. And again, it's another an example of the neocolonialist intelligentsia at work. They come from among us, but really don't have the interests of the masses of us at heart. And that's my take on it, without knowing a whole much about Boko Haram as some of the other panelists.
And Bobby, do you have anything you'd like to contribute to that particular point?
Can you restate the question, please?
Do you have anything you'd like to contribute on the issue of Boko Haram, which is the place in Nigeria, the kidnapping all these young students?
One thing I found very interesting is now this has opened up the floodgates for the U.S. to do a military intervention, and given this juncture in history, that's a very troubling series of events to take place, because you talk about neocolonialism. We know that the U.S. military has always been an institution that has strongly championed neocolonialism, so that can give room for one to ponder the thought of there's a bigger agenda at play for them to take such a drastic course of action.
Okay. Brother Anthony, and then I want to follow back Brother Haki and Nkrumah left a legacy in terms of strategy and tactics that African people must use in order to unify the continent. But one of the things he was clearly was against was having foreign powers on any of the shores of any of the African countries, not to have any kind of foreign powers or military bases on the country, in any country on the continent. We can see today that this thing called, this entity called AFRICOM, how could this have come about, given the lessons and the legacies of our previous history of looking at the colonizers? Anthony, what is the role of AFRICOM? How was they able to get in the territories of various African countries, known as AFRICOM, but we also understand they have CIA, FBI headquarters in certain countries. What impediment would that be against the unification of Africa and African people?
It's a major impediment against political unification, because it seeks to further division and also intensify the amount of coup d'etats that take place. And but it's a last-gasp effort, for imperialism to preserve its control over Africa. And at the moment, it's and it seems to the extent that that people aren't, you know, don't understand all the mechanisms through which neocolonialism operates. And AFRICOM was able to get a foothold in Africa because of leadership that serves the interests of the international bourgeoisie and really doesn't care about the masses of African people. And in several countries throughout Africa, you have leadership that is looking out for its own individual interests. They care about, you know, their wealth and well-being, but don't care about the masses of the people. And that is how AFRICOM was able to get a foothold by the bribery that of certain sectors of leadership that were alluded to by other panelists earlier.
And your response, Brother Haki?
Yeah, well, the country that's primarily responsible for AFRICOM's entrance into to Africa is Djibouti, the country of Djibouti, East Africa. And the president was given $230 million to allow them to set up a military base, the headquarters, right there in Djibouti. Now, when you think about $230 million is a paltry sum of money in terms of allowing someone to violate, you know, your jurisdictional integrity in terms of your land. That's a paltry amount of money. So it suggests to me that the leadership in Djibouti is going to pocket that money. It's not going to go toward benefiting the masses of the people one iota. I think that the reason why they picked Djibouti because not only is it situated in East Africa, but it's right across the waters to the Middle East, and so for them strategically it's very, very, very important. But of course they've been using Djibouti as a kickoff point where they can go throughout Africa and inhabit 52 countries as it currently stands in which they currently occupy. So, you know, clearly with the presence of these American soldiers, and we understand what we're showing one thing that's going to happen. That's the level of repression that exists among progressives or revolutionary sectors in Africa that they definitely can anticipate on in terms of being spied on, incarcerated, or killed, you know, in terms of protecting your Western interests. You know, whether or not other African countries acquiesce to U.S. and U.S. Involvement, you know, in Africa, whether or not it's going to result in something tangible for the African people, I don't know. I would like to believe that perhaps some African leaders are using the opportunity to get the weapons they need in terms of at some point taking a stand against the Western nation, particularly the United States. So maybe it's just a ploy, it's just a tactic in terms of getting what they need in terms of be able to in position to fight them. I'm hoping that some African leaders are thinking that way. But as it currently stands, of course, it's very difficult to ascertain if, in fact, that's what's going on. But we do know that their presence doesn't spell anything good for the continent of Africa.
And Jabari, do you have a take on that?
Well, one thing is for certain, with the large presence that AFRICOM have, they are attempting to maintain a long-term presence, and this isn't going to be an over-the-night flash and pan kind of scenario. And with that kind of presence, people have to be aware of all kinds of things that could happen because in an instant, any kind of progressive movement could be subject to come under a fierce attack.
No, I don't think we need to be aware that anything can happen, but also we need to be aware that things can happen. You still never find out about it until weeks and months, and maybe possibly years later, because they have a monopoly on the communication system, the TV networks, the major means of communication, the radios. I mean, just recently the thing in Nigeria, that didn't come out until about 3-4 weeks later. So I think we are in a very precarious situation in terms of looking at the importance of being able to communicate with each other in a timely fashion. One of the issues I would like to raise with the panel tonight is the issue of how do y'all view U.S. foreign policy? How has Barack Obama administration and their foreign policy, how has that policy played out as it relates to the interests of African development and African people unification? I start with you first, Brother Anthony, then Brother Aki and Jabari.
A careful analysis of U.S. foreign policy under the Obama administration shows that it's a continuation of U.S. foreign policy of the previous, U.S. presidents, Bush going back to Clinton, Bush the father, and so on. Let's see, it has not changed one iota under Obama. I mean, it's still a goal of the U.S. government to try to roll back the Cuban Revolution, for example. And ironically, let's see, Libya was invaded and its leadership decimated by under the Obama administration. And I think a lot of people don't have an understanding of this. And that's why people aren't out in the streets, because of the confusion that that's being sold by the neocolonialist intelligentsia once again, and we have and it's represented in the highest areas of political power, in this capitalist society.
Galaki.
Yeah, well, if people are not clear in terms of where Obama stands on Africa, they should be by now. This is the same man who refused to allow the U.S. to participate in the International Conference on Racism. So that says a lot in terms of what he feels about in terms of the marginalization and victimization and the oppression that inhabits that continent of Africa. So I think that he's very, very clear that his focus, his interest is in serving the needs of the ruling class. I think on that point he's very, 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 very good. In terms of the visits that he made to Africa, to my knowledge, outside of South Africa to see Mandela, there was one visit in which he was there for a very short period of time, and nothing of any real substance was discussed. I guess it was more of a tour for his wife and his daughters in terms of being able to say, hey, I went to the motherland, so... but clearly, he's very antagonistic toward the interests of Africa. In fact, he won't even talk about Africa. I mean, he doesn't even talk about Africa. At the very minimum, you can at least give lip service to the poverty, the suffering that exists among the people. Currently, the situation in Central Africa in terms of what's going on in Central Africa, I mean, we're approaching close to, 500,000 people losing their life. Obama has yet to declare that what was happening in Central Africa is tantamount to genocide, and therefore the international community need to move in terms of doing something. Now, we understand the international community ain't going to do a damn thing. I'm talking about the UN. It's not going to do a damn thing unless the United States tells them to do it. That's the only time they're going to do it. And at this point, Barack Obama absolutely refuses to talk to the UN in terms of the need, in terms of military forces over there and the Central Africa in terms of stopping genocide. These French forces over there who are not really concerned about the people in Central African Republic, because after all, the people who are actually invading that country serve the interests of the French, and so therefore they have no real desire in terms of stopping it. They allege that they can't stop it. It's just too overwhelmed by the sheer number. So therefore, what's going to happen is going to happen. So Barack Obama has no interest in Africa whatsoever. His interest is solely with the ruling class. In what they want. They want is the continuation the underdevelopment of Africa to continue, and Barack Obama is serving that purpose. And so for people who don't understand where he's coming from in terms of his role in terms of, or his view toward Africa, I think at this point it should be very, very clear that this guy has no intentions on doing anything that's going to benefit Africa.
And Jabari.
Well,
what's your take?
I would say that, as it is in previous data, it is an extension of previous presidential administration, but it also was something that greatly caught the masses of the people in terms of the U.S. because there were so many people that were just enamored with the package that they didn't consider what came with it. You know, they look at the appearance, the charisma, and things of that nature, and they didn't necessarily take the time to really do their research to see what is going to be coming with the Obama administration. And as you notice, given the several conflicts we find ourselves in, this only going to tell you what's on the horizon. You also look at the fact that he has access to some very dangerous high-tech technology. So it would be very interesting to see with all of this at disposal. We see where we are now, but the question is, where are we heading, and what can we really do to inform the masses about where we're going? Because, you know, this is a time where you think of a book like 1984, and you can draw the parallel, and you see it's very similar.
Okay, you know, as we talk about upcoming African Liberation Day 2014, and we take a look at African Liberation Day as an institution, what it represents, its principles, the ideals of unifying Africa into one homeland for all Africans at home and abroad. Some of these ideas or principles can be viewed or can be seen in terms of some of the policies and behavior that Omar Gaddafi tried to implement when he was in power in Libya. Now, since he is deceased, what lessons can we learn or should learn from this invasion as relates to U.S. aggression towards Africa, African people? What lessons do you think that we should learn from this particular invasion? It's not really talk about a lot in terms of its impact that it is having on Africa people today on the continent and off the continent. Brother Haki.
I think one of the things Senator, we can conclude is that because America has no interest whatsoever in Africa other than the rape of its resources, that anybody who stands to formulate a plan, a strategy, which is going to alleviate the suffering and injustice and the pain inflicted upon Africa, becomes an enemy of the United States. So I think Gaddafi had a great idea. I think the whole idea in terms of United Bank of Africa was very, very crucial. Because one of the things when we talk about in terms of the raping of Africa's resources and Africa's not being adequately compensated for the resources, one of the things is that we need to research, you know, in terms of, you know, adequately, you know, sizing up exactly, you know, what resources are worth in terms of their value. And so, therefore, what the bank would help you do that in terms of, from a global perspective, understanding what gold is worth, what silver is worth, what bauxite is worth, so forth and so on. So that kind of thing is very, 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 very important in Africa. Now, of course, America is with the satellites of very concerned in terms of, you know, anybody in the continent who dare formulate any kind of idea that's really going to alleviate the suffering in Africa. So I think, listen, we can take from that, Brother Africa, is that, you know, it's a long, hard, protracted struggle in terms of, you know, liberate Africa. But, you know, it's one that I'm glad to see that the All African People Revolutionary Party is taking upon in terms of, you know, just getting people, you know, not only in Africa but throughout the world, to focus on in terms of the need and the desire to change this paradigm and to create, create new ways of struggle against an intractable enemy who apparently is not going anywhere. So I think that the lesson we have to learn is that even though these people are vicious, they're very ruthless in terms of the level of violence they're willing to inflict on the people, we have to understand that for us as African people, we don't have a choice in terms of, we can't capitulate. We have to really, you know, we have to be willing to sacrifice in terms of bringing about the kind of Africa we need in terms of scientific socialism. So I think that's the message that we have to take from it, that we can't be afraid simply because they're ruthless and violent.
Brother Anthony, what lessons can we draw from this terrorist attack against Libya, this invasion? Not only from the U.S., but also from Europe. They all act as one.
Well, draw from that is the fact that imperialism is willing to do anything necessary to maintain its domination of Africa and the world. And that even forces that have worked with it, it has been shown throughout history that when certain leaders or organizations are no longer serve the interests of imperialism, imperialism is willing to liquidate them. And let's see, there were some times during Gaddafi's leadership of Libya that he did make concessions to imperialism. In order to buy time and whatnot. But capitalism works like the devil. When it's finished using you, it'll cast you aside. I think that's one lesson. And another lesson is the importance of permanent political organization. And I think this is where AOD is very helpful in terms of being providing an opportunity for further politically educating and organizing our people.
Okay. We talk about the issues that's going on in Africa and some of its contradictions. But given all of the contradictions it may have, one would ask you, as a Pan-Africanist, understanding the concept of Pan-Africanism, what importance is Africa to African people in the West and the rest of the world, Brother Haki and Brother Anthony? And can you make a connection in terms of why the Africans in the West should care about Africa more concretely, given the fact that many times people cannot think no farther than their present problems that they are encountering based on where they are?
Yeah, well, I think that if Western governments, particularly the United States, is going to take African people seriously, then you have to have a strong Africa. I mean, that is very, very important. I mean, an analogy, when you look at the treatment of historically of the Chinese people in terms of, their treatment they received in the United States, and you contrast that to today, which is a totally different ballgame. And so the reason being is that because you got a strong China, so therefore they're not in a position to simply, to do those kind of things, that tends to cast Chinese in a negative light. So conversely, when we look at the African people, if in fact if we'll be taken seriously, then we have to have a strong Africa. Now I also may add that with a strong Africa, it's not going to just benefit African people per se, but it's going to benefit all people because of its abundance of riches and resources. That in fact, that once Africa's position to create the paradigm in terms of, the kind of society that they want to see in the world, the kind of societies they want to see in the world, then Africa can make that come to fruition. It had a power to actually do that. So clearly, the benefits to African people is that, once you have a strong and consolidated Africa, then clearly the exploitation, the marginalization, the suppression of African people in terms of just their human rights right in the society will no longer be an issue because if you've got a strong Africa, the U.S. leadership will not dare do those kind of things because they recognize that if they persist in that kind of behavior, then there'll be repercussions from Africa, if they persist in those kind of behaviors, negative behaviors directed toward African people. So it's in African people's best interest to have a strong Africa. So I hope people do understand that fundamental necessity.
And Brother Anthony, what's your take?
Okay. Let's see. Without a unified, liberated Africa, Africans throughout the world, lack a national home. And I think that's one of the lessons taught by Nkrumah. Also, a united Africa would benefit, the world in terms of bringing about greater unity and alleviating the suffering of nearly a billion of the world's people. and that our you know, our liberation will bring about the end of help bring about the end of imperialism, which will benefit people worldwide, and that humanity can truly advance in harmony with nature.
When we talk about African Liberation Day, one of the major features of African Liberation Day is its international scope. Not only does it look at the problems of Africa, but look at the problems of Africa in relationship to the rest of the world. We recognize African Liberation Day as an institution and also part of the Pan-Africanist movement, as well as the international social movement. In terms of identifying who are African friends and who are African enemies, Brother Anthony, first then, Brother Haki, what assessment can you share with the people? How can we use history as a tool to identify who are our friends and who are our enemies, and how is that carried out in the institution of African Liberation Day, Brother Anthony?
Certainly. Well, let's see. All the people, all the political parties that are struggling for socialism are friends, because they're if they're struggling with socialism, they're fighting against capitalism in all of its manifestations, including imperialism, which is the highest stage of capitalism. Let's see, a couple of concrete examples would be Cuba, which has been struggling to build a socialist society for nearly 55 years. And some of our, some other organizations in the past that have struggled against imperialism, such as the various, Western Asian liberation organizations, the Palestinians, the Iraqis, who are struggling against similar problems that we are. Just manifesting in themselves in different forms. So I think, and I think we can learn a lot, as Malcolm taught us, from the struggles of other people against, a common enemy. So I think it's important that African Liberation Day retains its international character, and that we continue in that tradition of actually acknowledging and trying to work with our other friends that are also struggling against the same enemy that we're struggling against.
Yeah, I want to hold up for a second, Brother Aki. I just want to make this comment as it relates to the question I raised with Brother Anthony, because I was sort of very much impacted by my first trip to African Liberation Day around this issue of learning about all of these different movements and organizations. You know, when I was a young man, I never understood why were we supporting white folks in Ireland. It was at that institution they began displaying to us commonalities that we had with the Irish people in terms of that struggle. I also met some indigenous people. You know, they used to always tell us that the indigenous people were dead. They no longer existence. Well, I had a chance to run into the American Indian movement and representatives of the movement. I thought that was really interesting, along with the Palestinian movement. It was really interesting looking at these variations of these movements and how we all had common similarities and we were not each other's enemies. And that was one of the things that stood out a lot with me when I think about African Liberation Day. I think that's one of the things that you will encounter when you go to any serious African Liberation Day event. These should be some of the features that you should see and share in. Because my understanding of African Liberation Day as an institution, it came out a history of resistance, a history for a revolution and not for reform. So I thought that was really interesting in terms of when I first came into my first contact with African Liberation Day. I just want to appreciate the organizations such as the AVPRPGC who have been steadfast on maintaining this principle and dignity and understanding that not only is it about African people, but about all people in humanity who are oppressed to help fight together and move forward against worldwide imperialism and capitalism. But Brother Brother Haki, talk to our people. What is your position? Why is it important that they view or understand how Africa can have an impact on the lives of them in the Western Hemisphere as well?
The question with respect to in terms of international coalitions, is that also part of the question you want me to answer?
That'll be fine. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think you know. Yeah. Clearly, you know, just in terms of when you identify who's a friend or foe, I think Brother Anthony is absolutely correct. I mean, those individuals who are fighting for socialism are definitely perceived as friends. And the reason it's important because people have to understand that capitalism is not sustainable. When we talk about the destruction done to people, that's very, very clear in terms of people's lack of access to food, shelter, and health care. Those things adversely impact on the lives of people all over the globe, not just the United States, but all through the globe. But equally as devastating is that when you look at capitalism in terms of impact on the planet, I mean, capitalism is clearly not sustainable. And if capitalism persists, the danger for us all, for all human beings, is that the one planet we have, the only planet that we have, will in danger of being destroyed. And this is the real danger in terms of allowing capitalism to continue to exist. It's in our self-interest in terms of standing up in terms of the changes that are taking place, on this planet. Recently, there was a situation where they've been picketing Barack Obama in Washington, D.C. around the question in terms of the tar sands pipeline they want to lay out on the West Coast. Now, for people who don't know, tar sands is not like your traditional oil resources. Tar sands is much more stubborn. It's actually encased in rock-like material. And so the amount of energy you need in terms of extracting the oil, it takes a tremendous amount of energy, which creates a tremendous amount of heat. And one of the real problems is that aside from the carbon emissions, then the issue of heat in terms of destruction to the ozone layer. So, you know, clearly, people like the Koch brothers, these individuals who have a big stake in the Tarzan pipelines, a big, big stake, they want this to persist. They're not concerned about the health of the planet. They're concerned about the bottom line in their pocket. So we understand that people like the Koch brothers, you know, who are hell-bent on destroying the planet, we realize we can ill afford to allow people like that. We can ill afford to allow the government to empower people like that to continue doing these destructive things to the planet because we only have one planet. So socialism is the most efficient system in terms of addressing people's needs without destroying the planet. It's the most efficient way in terms of educating people, you know, without regard to their ability to pay. It's the most efficient way in terms of making damn sure people have places to live and live with some human dignity. All can be achieved without a devastating impact to the planet. So this is why it's so important that capitalism prevail. I mean, not capitalism prevail, but capitalism fails, but socialism prevails. And it's very important that we identify those people who understand, who think like we think, and who understand that the planet is, in fact, in peril because of capitalism, and that doing something in terms of addressing, you know, the elimination of capitalism is someone that to be respected in the mind, and those are the kind of people that you want to see out in terms of coalitions.
Okay, I believe we do have a caller on the phone who may have a question or comment. We can call off the caller, ask for a number, and they can speak. Caller, welcome to Africa on the Move. Caller number 4298. 4298. Your comment or question, please.
Hello, this is Brother Robert Moses.
Hey, brother, how you doing? Good, good.
All right. You all sound so beautiful, man. I mean, it's like I see intelligence. I see liberation ideology. I see people educating to liberate.
Well, I like that. Educate to liberate. That sounds good. Go ahead, brother. Continue.
Yeah, you know, we you know, we're in a united front with a lot of people on a lot of issues. And, you know, we have to maintain our united front and not reverse correct verdicts once we've established certain principles. And so we got to keep moving forward. And I just think you all sound so good, and you know, I support Pan-Africanism, and I've been in the struggle for a minute, starting back with the African Liberation Support Committee. I don't know if you know about them back in the 70s, but we were one of the key players in those days was Eritrea.
Mm-hmm.
And the international students wanted liberation in those days. I don't know, but we have, the world is complex, and you know, there are a lot of issues, and I just say keep on keeping on, and I hope, you know, definitely without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. And I think right now, V.I. Lenin's April thesis, remember that, V.I. Lenin's April thesis, that's what we need to be focusing on right now. No support whatsoever to revolutionary defensivism of the government. The government is corrupt, it's played out. It's time for a new world order. Anyway, I'll talk to you later.
All right, brother. Continue to listen. We thank you for your support, as always. Brother Moses, we thank you. Continue to listen. Again, to our listeners, we'd like to encourage you to feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. We'd like to hear your views, your comments. Because again, now that we come together with this unity of thought, we have never had this unity of action. In terms of formulating a plan, a collective plan, where all African people will be involved in towards achieving the founding destination of freedom and liberation. So we'll continue our discussion. Matter of fact, Brother Mosley brought up an interesting point. I'd like to raise with Brother Anthony and Brother Hakeem, you can give a response to it afterwards. He raised the question of building an African United Front. I know that was one time Brother Kwame Ture and the All African People Revolutionary Party was one of the leading proponents of trying to put together a front. And we know fronts comes about based upon certain conditions, certain objectives that must be available to make a front happen and make it be effective. Brother Anthony, right now, where is the party at this point in time around this question of African United Front? And if we got a front today, how important would it be in terms of aiding the advancement of our people? What would it take, first and foremost, to even just get an African United Front? How do you see this right now, looking at the condition of the African people, Brother Anthony?
Right now, because of neocolonialist leadership, it's not feasible at present. Let's see, without a higher level of organization among our people. And one of the things that works against that is the level of disorganization that exists in our community today. And also, a lot of people, there's this confusion over the correct solution to our problem among our people. For reasons we alluded to earlier, the backwards educational system was subjected to, and also a corrupt intelligentsia that serves the interests of the imperialists. And as I mentioned earlier, they're represented in all sectors of our society, whether you're talking about entertainment, media, athletics, religion, politics, etc. So it is very difficult, and it was because of the neocolonial intelligentsia that a front was prevented from coming to fruition. I do think it's important, that it develops, but I think it's going to take a higher level of organization among our people than exists presently to bring that about.
Okay, and Brother Hackey, one of the other obstacles many people allude to in terms of that is an impediment to our unity is there seems to be an issue of not recognizing or not addressing the class contradiction among us. Can you talk to us a little bit about the role of class and how it plays itself out in terms of being an impediment to our people moving forward?
Class is perhaps the biggest impediment in terms of moving forward. I think that this one of the things with class is that once you internalize this notion that things define you as a human being, then you're pretty much your behavior is pretty much predictable, and that is the problem. For those individuals who have the big house and big car and a little money in the bank, who think that they've arrived, they're less likely in terms of seeing necessity in terms of struggle because in their mind they've made it. And of course, these rules are established by the ruling class, by the oppressors in terms of, who want to put out those kind of values in terms of hoping people gravitate toward those kind of values and make them their home. And that's precisely what class is all about, because you got so many in the African community who in fact really believe that things define who they are as a human being. And so, therefore, they don't have a problem. And also, the question in terms of fundamental a lack of education is that often when you critique this issue in terms of capitalism, versus socialism, a lot of the people in terms of who have that class inclination are likely to come down the side of capitalism. In fact, they see it as the greatest thing since white bread. And of course it's absurd, but nonetheless that is what they believe. And just in terms of having discourse with these kind of people becomes extremely, extremely important. They are more likely to get agitated because they fundamentally don't understand why you don't see capitalism as the greatest system in the world. And despite of all the problems that happen in capitalism, I mean, despite all the stuff that you see, the deficit between the rich, the have and the have not, the unemployment, the lack of education for children, no affordable houses for people. Despite all these problems in their face, they still intend to see things from a very individualist perspective. In other words, in terms of gauging the world, they see themselves at the center point in terms of understanding those things around them without understanding that, in fact, there's a system in place which creates all these problems that you point out in the first place. So it's a very difficult discussion. But let me just say something in terms about the United Front, though. And perhaps the biggest problem, in addition to class, is this whole notion in terms of a lot of sectarianism that exists in terms of various groups. I think when we talk about sectarianism, when we talk about the position that people take in terms of my line is more primary than your line, my line is much sharper than your line, my line is better than your line. So it tends to get in the way in terms of creating a united front. So first and foremost, even before we begin to talk about a united front, we have to begin to have these informal discourse with other groups in terms of, in terms just around ideas in terms of which way forward. Because as long as we depend on our own individual line in terms of leading us, then those lines that are not consistent with our own, then it gets in the way in terms of actually creating a united front. So we're going to have to have those kind of discussions as a starting point. But those kind of things are not likely to materialize, over a short period of time. So we talk about United Front, we talk about a much longer period of time because those discussions have to take place and we have to be on the same accord. Because during the process of those discussions, you're going to have people leaving and you have people coming. Clearly those people who are who see that the conflicts around line are just unreconcilable, they're going to leave. But then there are new people who understand necessity in terms of, this kind of struggle around line in terms of which way forward, and who understand that the only way we can resolve this thing is get together in terms of, to achieve one objective. So it's going to be a struggle. It's not going to be an easy one, but it's going to be a struggle, and it has to take place on an informal level in terms of kicking off this process.
Okay, point well said. One of the things I would like to do before we close out the program is we would like to go back just a little bit as relates to discussing this question of neocolonialism. And we look at or view neocolonialism as a means or something unique just to Africa. I think also you must at least articulate to our people that we have neocolonialists here in the States. Brother Anthony, can you talk about this neocolonial aspect as it relates to Africans in the United States?
Certainly. As I pointed out earlier, Africans were in the diaspora were taken from Africa. So we're landless for that reason. We don't control our land. And Africans that remained on the continent had our land taken from them. So we suffer a common problem of landlessness in that sense. In terms of the neocolonialism manifests itself, we have a lot of people that are puppets for imperialism, that are in our leadership inside our communities, either in politics, media, religion, entertainment, etc. And without individualizing it, a lot of these people in these fields serve to maintain the interests of imperialism because they believe in the imperialist ideology that emphasizes individualism over collectivism. And people, especially in capitalist societies, see themselves as more important than the whole. So, that's where a lot of those ideas come from. And
yeah,
the counter for that...
Go finish, brother. Finish, please.
All right. Yeah, sure. And the counter for that is the political education of the masses of our people.
Yeah, because I'd just like to add to this, and Brother Aki, you can weigh in on it. Many people look at your males, 99% of them, your African governors, 99% of them, your so-called African president. When you look at those positions, when you look at folks or people who are running education institutions and making sure they develop curriculums that are European-centric, it imbues racism, it distorts the history not only of African people, but people in general in the world. All these people are no more than agents or neocolonists. And when we talk about changing the system, we can't be so idealistic and say that if they're institutions, that means people make up institutions. So you must hold people accountable. How do you respond to that position, Brother Aki? Does that make sense to you?
Well, if you're going to further the movement, then you have to hold people responsible. But you have to have a sharp understanding in terms of, who supports change and who doesn't. And so when people deviate, from that support in terms of trying to bring about a better world, then they have to be confronted. And the question in terms of how you confront them, you have to be confronted on many, many levels. You know what I mean? It depends on in terms of the level which, these people are resistant in terms of trying to bring about change. But to the extent that they're going to undermine or hurt what you're trying to do in terms of trying to bring about the change, then your response has to be equal and proportionate. So I think that people like that, people who represent high office, who portray the people consistently, who get paid a little money, for the sole purpose of oppressing their people or deceiving their people, then those people have to take a stronger stand in terms of making sure they understand that what they're doing is just simply not tolerable. And if that means that you have to do something maybe like in terms of organizing around getting their ass out of office, then that's what you got to do. Or if it means to have an informal chat at their office, then that's what you got to do. But you got to do what you got to do in terms of making sure you convey the point that this movement is damn serious and nobody is going to derail this movement, nobody. So we don't care how much money you make, what kind of job you got, that if you undermine this movement, then you got to be dealt with. It's that simple. But we have to get people to the consciousness where they understand what they're damn serious about, bringing about change in society. And it's going to take that kind of commitment in terms of, being in a position in the first place to make damn sure that people don't undermine their movement. So, yes, I think they have to be. You have to deal with people like that, these counter-revolutionaries, you know, who deceive the people, who manipulate the people, who prop up, you know, his capitalist system, you know, despite the exploitation of his people. So, yes, it has to be dealt with. No question about that.
Okay, I'd like to make a response to some of our supporters who is online, who is on our chat line. And unfortunately, I see you on the line, but this is a technology that we are in the process of still learning how to use. We apologize that we couldn't get to your question today, but we would like for you, if you could, take your question and email it to us. If you email it to African_Awareness_Association@yahoo.com. This particular program is a community project for the African Awareness Association, Africa on the Move. Until hopefully next week, we'll have that master that aspect of the technology. We'll be able to communicate with you directly. We apologize, but we see you online. You have questions, and we will make sure that next program, if you email us our questions, your questions, we will answer it, and hopefully next time we will have improved upon this technology. So we'd like to thank you for your participation and your willingness to engage with us on our chat line. But unfortunately, like all things, everything's a process. We're in the process of learning this technology, and at the same time, we are in the process of organizing a new format for Africa on the Move. Basically, we've been a bi-weekly program, a half-hour program. We'd like to extend it to at least a weekly program, 2 hours, like tonight. But in order to do that, we'd like to have your support. If you see any contribution that you can send to help us, we'd be greatly appreciated. So make your contribution out to the African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, 23220. P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, 23220. Brother Anthony, we only have a few minutes left, and I think it's important that we sort of close this program out with you sharing with the audience exactly what is the All African People Revolutionary Party and its history.
Okay. The All African People's Revolutionary Party is a mass, independent, socialist, pan-Africanist political party based in Africa that was founded by Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah in 1968. And we have organized in various countries throughout the world, on the continent and in various areas of the diaspora. And our objective is Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. Our ideology is Nkrumahism, Toureism. And our program is building the AAPRPGC through the development of a conscious revolutionary cadre.
And what are some of the coalitions and alliances that you have established?
Sure. We've established, the SMASH FBI-CIA coalition, military industrial complex, SMASH Zionism. We have over the years established alliances with various revolutionary organizations and political parties around the world, such as the Pan-Africanist Congress of Zania, ZANU-PF, the Zimbabwe African National Union, Popular Front.
Okay, Brother Anthony, we're going to have to stop you right there and let the people know to find out more information about the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Please go to that website by going to www.aaprp-gc.org. Or you can call them at 202-719-0529. We'd like to encourage everyone to come out this year, support African Liberation Day 2014. It'll be Saturday, May the 17th, up at Washington, D.C. It will take place at the Festival Center, located at 1640 Colonial Road, Northwest, Washington, D.C. Please, come home. This is the only time you can go home while I have to pay a lot of money. Mother Africa needs you. Come to African Liberation Day. We hope to see you there. Be there or be square. Forward to Africa. Forward to Africa. This has been another special program on Africa on the Move. We thank everybody for their support. We thank our panelists, Brother Zabaria, Brother Haki, Brother Anthony, and of course we thank our Brother Moses for being supportive and calling in. Again, we'll see you next time. Please support African Liberation Day. Until then, let's go forward ever, backwards never. Forward ever, backwards never. Forward ever, backwards never.